Burton sort of remembers.
So, there I am, in bear country, deep in the wilds of Canada, which is like America, only without the mad bits. And I'm asking a bear expert what you should do if a bear is giving you the impression that it wants to eat you. And he says you should use extreme assertiveness, which I thought was probably a euphemism for a gun. But no, he then shows me some phone footage of a very large grizzly bear about to step through the open doorway of an observation hide towards the human occupants. And the bear expert is blocking the bear's path, and he's talking to it in a very non-threatening, friendly way. And he's saying, "Okay, big fella, you back up now. That's far enough. You're not allowed in here. You know the rules." Only the bear looks like he doesn't know the rules. He's starting to step through the doorway, and this bear's a few feet away now, and it's towering over this man, and the man's saying, "Hey fella, just relax. Okay, no closer now, because..." Yeah, and this bear jumps backwards as if to say, "What the hell happened there? Yeah, I didn't know these little pink bears could do that." Then the grizzly stands there for a moment, bewildered, and then decides it doesn't want any more surprises, and it turns and ambles away. I mean, it was an extremely startling noise that the bear expert had made, very loud, from the pit of his stomach, but very effective. So that's a useful tip. This episode's going to be full of useful tips. If you ever find an unwelcome bear on your doorstep, just suddenly go, "Ha!" It'll probably work with Jehovah's Witnesses. Yeah. Maybe even those kids selling oven gloves and chamois leathers. Although they are very persistent. Yeah. We've got a cupboard full of oven gloves. It's like some monument to liberal guilt. So, why did I tell you a story about a bear? Actually, why did I tell you? Oh, yeah. Because this time, my sort of memories are going to be all about animals, because I love animals. Yeah, animals are beautiful, aren't they? And so tasty. Now, I've been very lucky, you know, because for someone who grew up in central London, I'm privileged to have lots of close encounters with extraordinary animals, sort of in my memory bank. And these encounters have made me a firm believer in animal rights. You know, I strongly believe in animal rights, but also in animal responsibilities. Because there are some species of animal that do have a tendency to let themselves down, rather. And I'm thinking specifically of dogs here, because let's face it, dogs are allowed to do stuff that human beings would never be allowed to do. You know, we cut dogs enormous amounts of slack. I mean, imagine if you were walking down the road past the house and the owner of the house came running out and started shouting and jumping at the gate going, "Who are you? I don't know you. Get away from my house. Get away from my house. My loved ones are in that house. I don't know you. Get away from my house. Go on, get..." Oh, you've got a biscuit. That would not be tolerated, would it, in humans. You know, similarly, imagine if you were in a town centre on a Saturday night and you saw a man and a woman meet for the first time on the street, and within 30 seconds, you know, they were copulating in full view. Actually, you can see that in most towns on a Saturday night. Now, that's a bad example. All right, then. All right, here's another example. Imagine you're at a dinner party and the hostess's husband bites you and she says, "Oh, that's not like him." That's the kind of slack, that's the kind of problem that I think we're talking about. It's perhaps unfair to blame dogs for their behaviour. It's often the dog owners who can be the problem with their sort of laissez-faire attitude. The street I grew up in had a pub, and the publican had a very fierce Alsatian called Sabre. And one day, a mate of my brother's, perhaps a little unwisely, went to stroke Sabre, and Sabre bit him hard, you know. And so this kid's hand was impaled by the dog's teeth. It was trapped in the dog's mouth, and the dog wasn't letting go. And the publican said, "Don't try and pull your hand out, he'll think you're playing." Yeah, no squeaky toys for Sabre. No, apparently his idea of a game had to involve human tissue. Yeah. Of course, it's not just dogs. Cats also let themselves down rather. I'm talking about the staring thing. That's just rude, isn't it? The way a cat keeps looking at you just to see if you'll crack, you know? When I was little, we had a cat with a pretty intimidating what-are-you-looking-at stare. We got it as a kitten. But its father was a feral cat from the cemetery. And our cat, Timmy, it took after its dad. It was vicious. Me and my brother thought it was great and exciting because it attacked everything. You know, furniture, Great Danes, postman. Well, it was his own fault. He put his hand too far into our litter box and Timmy was very territorial. This cat, this wild cat, was afraid of nothing and nobody apart from the Hoover. No, the Hoover was its mortal enemy with its incessant roaring and its impregnability. So when Mum Hoovered, the cat would hide under a chair. And occasionally it would pluck up the courage to dash out, cuff the Hoover with its paws, and then run away again. But then one day, the cat got lucky. Yeah, it discovered quite by chance that its enemy had a fatal weakness. Because the cat dashed out, slashed at the bag with its claws, and suddenly its enemy disgorged sooty entrails all over the floor and into the air. And of course, once they've made a kill, cats don't forget a hunting strategy. So after that, every time Mum did the hoovering, the cat would dash out, rip the bag open and run away. Yeah. Mum wasn't as fond of the cat as we were. Gone off at a bit of a nostalgic tangent there, where was I? Oh, yeah. Animals that let themselves down. Well, there's one species that is ludicrously irritable and aggressive. So irritable and aggressive, in fact, that it could get a job as President Trump's press spokesman. And I'm talking, of course, about the hippo. Now, hippos kill more people in Africa than any other animal, and yet they refuse to address their behaviour. And here's how I nearly became a hippo statistic. My wife, Libby, and I were out on Lake Naivasha in Kenya at dawn. We were birdwatching, watching kingfishers. It was beautiful. And we were in a boat, a little skiff being piloted by a little local boy. And we spotted some hippos grazing on the shore opposite, quite unusual to see. So the little boy slammed the skiff into gear, went zzz, and we went scooting round to get a closer look at these hippos. And the hippos heard us coming. They're a bit startled, and they all plunged into the water, all bar one, who we had accidentally cut off on the shoreline. He was marooned, and he wasn't happy. No, he was bellowing and roaring, and he was jumping up and down in the shallows. Now, you're going to say to me, Andy, hippos can't jump. I'm telling you, that hippo was jumping. He was furious. And this little boy turned to me, and he said, you see that hippo on the shoreline? I said, what, the one that's roaring and bellowing? He said, yeah. He said, that's the bull hippo. I said, oh, right. He said, and you see all these hippos behind us? And I turn around, and there are all these hippos in the water behind us. I said, yeah. He said, that's his harem. So I said, so is this a good place to be? Between the bull hippo and his harem? And he said, no, it's very dangerous. He said, but luckily, he's scared of the outboard, so he won't come near. And then to illustrate, he revved the outboard. He went, zzz, 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 zzz. And there was this awful silence. All I could hear was the lapping of the water against the side of the boat. And then this bull hippo did a double take. Now, again, you're going to tell me, Andy, hippos can't do double takes. They're not comically trained. Well, I'm telling you, this hippo did a double take, that Oliver Hardy would have been proud of, as he realised that his mortal enemy, the outboard, had died, and that there was a beat, and then he plunged into the water and started swimming towards us at great speed. You know, and I didn't know what to do. I turned round and I glanced behind us, and I could see all these eyes in the water, just blinking, all the eyes of the female hippos thinking, oh, this will be good. Yeah, and the bull hippo is accelerating towards us even faster. And I'm thinking, well, you know, this is, and it's interesting because people say that your life flashes before your eyes, don't they? They say when you're about to die, your life flashes before your eyes. I didn't get that. I did get a brief glimpse of an old episode of Sooty. but I do remember one big thought that dominated my mind, and that thought was, what a stupid way for a Fulham boy to die. You know, I was mentally picturing people looking at my gravestone in Brompton Cemetery going, killed by a hippo, what a muppet. But anyway, so now he's really close now, and you know, I'm really panicking. My wife, she's commendably calm and composed, and she's taking a bloody photo. And we've got it. It's a great photo. It's a photo of a hippo with a sodding great bow wave in front of its face. Anyway, and the little boy is tugging wildly at the cord of the outboard, and I'm thinking, well, maybe I should intervene. And I think, no, you know, trust the local knowledge. It's his boat. He's 7. You know, we're entrusting our lives to this 7-year-old. Anyway, finally, He manages to get the outboard going again, and he revs it, goes zzz, 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 and the bull hippo slams on the brakes, and the water boils, and then he's a few feet away now, and then he opens his mouth. Now, I don't know if any of you have ever been a few feet from the gaping maw of a hippo's mouth, but it's quite unsettling, mostly because of the teeth, you know, those tusks, they're 2 feet long. They're vegetarians, for God's sake. You know, you don't need teeth that size to eat salad. Just to chop tourists in half. So anyway, the little lad, he threw the outboard into gear, and we went zzz, and we hightailed it away from that. And do you know what? Just telling that story has got the adrenaline pumping. You know, I can feel my heart in my chest, you know, and to this day, if someone starts a game of hungry hippos, I have to leave the room. No, seriously. Just got to calm down now. In my lifetime, our attitude towards the animal kingdom has definitely improved, because there's no doubt we did have an extremely bad attitude, and for that I blame God. No, because he gave Adam and Eve the distinct impression that animals were here purely for human benefit. In the book of Genesis, God says the following: let us make man in our image, and let man rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over the earth, and all of the creatures that move along the ground. That is what God says. More than once, in fact, because he can go on a bit. Well, if you're God, no one's going to say, oh, you've already said that. Actually, I notice he only says fishes of the sea. So maybe trout is forbidden. Oh, don't get bogged down on religion, Andy. Could affect sales to America. Yeah. I think there is a general acceptance now that all animals are an important part of a delicately balanced ecosystem, even the annoying ones that ruin picnics. We were once checking out a possible filming location in the Highlands of Scotland, and it was about February, and this farmer was showing us around, and we were due to be filming in July, so I said, do you get many midges here in the summer? And he said, oh, aye, yeah, many midges. And our producer, who was a very positive person, said, oh, well, that's okay, because we've got this brilliant gadget that emits CO2 and it traps the midges and kills them. It's a very effective machine. And the farmer looked at him and said, have you got 6 billion of them? And a few months later, we found out what he meant. You know. certainly in the world of TV, attitudes towards animals have changed a great deal. I mean, I remember in 1979 working briefly on the Russell Harty show. And that week, one of Russell's celebrity guests was a showbiz bear called Hercules, grizzly bear, nearly 8 feet tall. And at one point in rehearsals, he got stuck in the wings because he was a bit claustrophobic. And he got quite upset. And the way they calmed this bear down was they gave him a massive saucepan full of prawns. So there's another useful bear tip. If your fails and he's about to attack, just whip out a saucepan full of prawns. Yeah. Take him out of the packet first, though, because you know, otherwise the fiddliness might enrage him. Anyway, that whole situation would never be allowed now. You know, dangerous animals are not allowed to guest on chat shows. Graham Norton would not be allowed to sit a grizzly bear on his sofa between Gwyneth Paltrow and Michael McIntyre. Sorry, I'm just pausing to enjoy the mental picture. Michael doing his trademark skipping and getting mistaken for prey. No, that would not be allowed now. Not just because of safety, because it is cruel to coerce animals into stressful situations purely for the purposes of entertainment. You know, and that's definitely an advance. So that's why circuses no longer have big cats. You know, quite right too. Though I did once sit through a very long performance of Cirque du Soleil wishing someone would lob in a tiger. The other big change that's occurred and still occurring is we're questioning our preconceptions about animals, because for a long time now we've accepted the Darwinian model. You know, we've all watched the Attenborough programs where the two strongest stags battle it out for hours to decide who will be the dominant stag who gets to impregnate all the females. But there is mounting evidence that quite often, while the two alpha stags are knocking each other senseless, one of the smaller, weedy stags quietly shags all the females. It's true. Yeah. And this version really appeals to me, for obvious reasons. And maybe it still is a version of natural selection, because arguably, it's the most intelligent male whose genes get handed on, isn't it? Rather than the tall, thick, pretty boys. Another change I've seen over the last 60 years or so is in our notions of animal consciousness, because it's emerging that it's far more advanced than we thought. There are various tests can be applied. One test of consciousness is whether a creature can envisage a future outcome. You know, whether it can plan ahead. And I saw an example of this in Madagascar, where there were families of brown lemurs who would approach these little dishes of water that had been left out for them with astonishing wariness. You know, they would hover and hesitate, and eventually one of them would sort of inch forward and touch the dish and then back away very quickly. And the locals explained to us why the lemurs were behaving in this very jumpy way, because a few months previously, the local boa constrictor had coiled himself around the base of a tree to make himself into what was in effect a big circular dish where rainwater would collect. And then he kept very, very still. And for several weeks, the lemurs had come and blithely sipped water from this new receptacle, until one day they came to drink from the dish and it ate one of them. And that is why the lemurs were now so scared of dishes, because that would make you nervous. You know, if an inanimate object suddenly devoured your mate, that would... Now, that boa constrictor is clearly an animal of very high intelligence, because if I set my mind to it, I could probably catch a lemur, you know. But it would never occur to me to disguise myself as crockery. That's really thinking outside the box, isn't it? That's original thought. Of course, the poster boys for animal intelligence are dolphins. They are perceived as being extremely intelligent, though if they were that bright, they wouldn't swim around so close to Japan. But I've seen the subtlety of dolphin intelligence close up. The first time was in 1979 when I wrote a sketch for Not the 9 o'clock News about a third presidential candidate who was competing in the election against Carter and Reagan and who was a dolphin. So we went to film some dolphins at Woburn. Captive dolphins, obviously. They weren't lost. And the sketch involved teaching the dolphins some new tricks, including wearing a straw boater on their head. Not easy for a dolphin. But the trainer got the alpha dolphin, Smarty. And eventually, Smarty worked out that if when the trainer threw this weird hat into the pool, if he came up with the hat balanced very precariously on his smooth head and then swam back at snail slow speed, then he'd be rewarded. But the director wanted to film lots of dolphins doing this trick, and it didn't look like there'd be time to train them. And the other dolphins had not seen Smarty learn this trick. And yet, when the other dolphins were released into the pool, they all immediately did what Smarty had done. They all swam slowly under the hats, no hesitation whatsoever. So the only explanation was that Smarty had told them. So whatever dolphin language is, it is complex enough to convey the thought, if you swim very slowly and balance this weird thing on your head, they'll give you lots of fish. It seems to me that's the only explanation. You know, I mean, unless dolphins have some secret fetish for straw boaters. You know. Maybe they're all Maurice Chevalier fans or something. Now, while we were filming that dolphin sketch, long, long before the days of mobiles, I asked if I could use the phone. And the trainer said, sure. You can use the phone in my office. Ignore the sea lion. And sure enough, there was a sea lion in his office, just sitting on a chair with his flippers on the desk, like a sort of very ugly boss. Now, I don't know if you've ever made a phone call while being watched by a sea lion, but it's quite unsettling, you know. And as I made my call, he just stared at me relentlessly as if he was angry about the bill I was running up. You know? And as I left the office, his eyes watched me all the way to the door as if to say, oh, right, not leaving a contribution then, cheapskate. In the mid-1980s, my wife and I had an encounter with a wild dolphin off the coast of Pembrokeshire by a lovely village called Solva. It was Easter, many years ago, before kids. And Libby and I went out on a little boat into the bay to see if we could meet this wild dolphin who'd taken up residence and who the locals had named Simo. And sure enough, Simo turned up, and Libby, who's a very strong swimmer, mum's a world champion swimmer, and Libby got into the water with Simo the dolphin, and he started to interact with her. Now, it had been explained to us that Simo was a male adolescent dolphin, but I'm not sure we'd fully taken on board what that might entail. Anyway, the dolphin and Libby are frolicking away, having a good time. And the dolphin's showing off. He's doing some jumps for her. And then he pulls Libby along with his fin. And then she realises it isn't his fin. And then Libby feels maybe she should get back on the boat because he's getting a little bit boisterous. So she swims towards the ladder at the rear of the boat. But the dolphin realises that his new best friend is about to desert him. So he intercepts her. And he gets between her and the ladder. And he just lolls there, you know, floating, belly up, just making it extremely awkward for Libby to get to the ladder. You know, she would have had to climb over him, basically, which he looked like he might enjoy. Now, I don't know if any of you have had your partner propositioned by a dolphin, but it's socially quite awkward, you know? I mean, what could I do? I couldn't ask him to step outside, could I? And I couldn't get in and fight him because I can't swim, and that would definitely have given him the advantage. So. Anyway, eventually we did manage to get Libby back onto the boat, but I was left with a clear impression that we'd been involved in a battle of wits with an animal that was intelligent enough to devise a strategy for sexual harassment. It's funny, do you know what? I'm not sure I've ever told that story on a stage before. In fact, I haven't even told that story to our three kids, Pip, Robbie and Flipper. Right, pencil and paper at the ready, listeners. Another useful animal tip coming up. We once filmed a scene for Drop the Dead Donkey that involved several alligators. And all the crew were given a very long safety briefing. And as a co-producer, I was partly responsible for everyone's survival. And a special caged paddock was built to contain the alligators. But when we started to film, the alligators just looked like models, you know, inert, all clustered in one corner. So our director, Lydia Oldroyd, asked the handler if some of them could be moved more into shot. So the handler let herself into the cage paddock and she approached the biggest alligator and said, "Where do you want it?" And Liddy, the director, said, a bit to the left. And the handler grabbed this very large alligator by the tail and she dragged it to the left. And then the alligator started to get a bit grumpy. And as it span its head backwards to snap at her, she whacked it on the nose with a rolled up newspaper. Yeah. And the alligator backed off. I think that was her version of extreme assertiveness. Yeah, all that health and safety briefing, and a woman had gone in alone, armed with a rolled-up newspaper. And afterwards, I asked her about it, and she said, "Well, you can do that to an alligator, you know, because they're very easy to dominate. But if I'd done that with a crocodile, I'd be dead now." So, that's the useful tip. If you ever need to subdue an alligator, whack it on the snout with a rolled up newspaper. Having first Googled the difference between an alligator and a crocodile. So you'll probably need very fast broadband. Thank you for accompanying me through the hazy hall of mirrors that is my memory. I'm going to leave you with one final animal tip. Again, based directly on personal experience. Never, ever put on a boxing glove that's got a wasp inside it. Thank you and goodbye.
Andy Hamilton Sort of Remembers was written and performed by Andy Hamilton. The producer was Claire Jones. It was a BBC Studios production.